Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, family. Thank you so much for joining us again for our latest episode of Blog Talk Radio. And with We Hear You, this is Atiba Buchanan. I am the host. Joining me today, as always, is my permanent co-host, David Seaton, and my other permanent co-host, which was away last week, but is back again today, Ms. Rashida Graham Washington. Hey, hey.
Welcome back.
Hey, hey.
We are so glad to have you back and safe with us. And we're so glad to have you able to go ahead and participate with us today on these wonderful, wonderful topics. We have a lot to discuss, so we're just going to get right to it, people. We're going to talk about violence in Chicago as it pertains to the young lives that were lost this week. I'm going to mention them by name. We're looking at Kaylin Pryor and Tyshawn Lee. Tyshawn Lee was 9 years old. It had been reported, his age had been reported between 8 and 9, but I think they settled on 9 years old. Very tragic story. Young man who was shot. Both of these people were shot on the same day, on Monday, November the 2nd. And he was lured into an alley, apparently, by what they think is a gang member that was trying to, I guess, use his death as leverage against his father, which is wholly unacceptable. He was shot multiple times.
That's correct.
In the face. So the police know just by the way that he was executed that it wasn't an accident. They know that he was targeted. And they have a strong suspicion, as from what I've even seen today on CNN, as to who may have been involved. They are having a difficult time proving it. And that's the challenge with with the legal system. It's not just knowing what you know, but it's being able to prove what you can. And then we have snuffed out at 20 years old, terribly, Miss Kaylin Pryor. She was shot in Chicago on the 7300 block of South May in Englewood. She had a bullet hit her on the armpit in a drive-by shooting where she was waiting on a bus to go back home to Evanston. She's not even from Chicago. So unfortunately, she was just visiting her grandmother on the way back home, and she ends up getting shot in a drive-by shooting. She was not targeted. They're speculating, they being the police, are speculating that she was shot while standing next to a 15-year-old who is a documented gang member. But they don't think that she knows the young man that she was shot next to. He was shot in the right buttocks, and he was in critical condition last I knew. Or last it was reported. This young lady had recently won a Mario Tricocci modeling contest. She beat out 500 other contestants. She's a high school graduate, and she had big ambitions. She was looking to model just to use that as a means to pay for her ultimate dream, which was to become a lawyer. She wanted to attend law school. So we have two very heartbreaking situations today. We have two young lives cut off far too soon. And it's time to go ahead and make some changes in Chicago and in our community. Coming to join us today to talk about this is Mr. T.O. Hardeman. He's also known as Mr. Ceasefire, for those that are familiar with him. He'll be calling in just a moment. Before we get to him, David and Rashida, do you guys have any thoughts on these two tragic situations? Let's go to Rashida first.
Thank you so much, Atiba. Yeah, my heart obviously is grieved by the news. Just this whole, what I would call an epidemic at this point. I was out of the city. I was in Guatemala on the 2nd when these two shootings occurred, and people in the country I was in, way in Guatemala City, were talking about these incidents and asking me about the safety of our city. So, of course, we first and foremost grieve the lives that are lost, and we'll talk more about that. But, to be somewhere halfway across the country, across the world, and have this be the reputation that our city is acquiring is also disheartening, that when you say you're from Chicago, it's not greeted by the same tradition of excellence that our forefathers and grandmothers experienced, but rather the first thing people are asking me when I was in Guatemala was, do you still feel safe there? And, oh my gosh, it's such a shame all the shooting that's happening there. That's what we've come to be known for. So I'm interested in talking more with Brother Tio about that and just, you know, that we're losing the life, which is most important, but we're also gaining a reputation that is not savory.
Well, just a coattail on that, that's not anything necessarily new to Chicago. You go back a few decades, and if you went anywhere in the world and said you were from Chicago, the first thing people thought of was Capone. First thing people thought of, you know, was the violence back then. My larger issue with this whole situation is just the breakdown in the policing of Chicago. What's going on with the Chicago Police Department that they are not policing our city and keeping our citizens and our youth safe? That's the biggest thing to me. I mean, bad things happen. People get shot every day, but in Chicago, you know, it's almost to the point where people are getting shot every day. You know, someone's being murdered almost every day in the city of Chicago. What is going on with the CPD, and why are they dropping the ball so badly?
Wow, well, we got a great setup. I appreciate you guys' perspective. Right now, we are going to bring in Mr. T.O. Hardiman, also known as Mr. Ceasefire. We are so privileged to have everyone today. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He is executive director for Violence Interrupters. He has dedicated his life and career to community organizing for peace and social change. In 1999, Mr. Hardiman joined Ceasefire, an award-winning public health model that has been scientifically proven to reduce shootings and killings. In 2004, T.O. created the Violence Interrupters Initiative. Mr. Hardiman, are you there?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Yeah, I'm here with you. I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. We again appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us today, and we definitely would like to get your perspective on these two shootings in Chicago. Again, the young man, Tyshawn Lee, and Miss Kaylin Pryor. When you heard these stories, because again, they both happened on the same day, what were your initial thoughts?
Well, you know, it's nothing new in Chicago, number one. And mainly, I just want to be clear with everybody that's listening. The African-American community, we will never get to a point where we reduce the violence into African-American people unify in Chicago and across the nation. Right now, it was Tyshawn Lee, you know, a week ago. It was a grandmother and her daughter about a month ago. And you got a little kid that was found in the pond with his head cut off. We have a serious issue in the African-American community. Over 85% of all homicides that occur in Chicago take place in the African-American community. The police cannot get in there and penetrate the community deep enough to stop the violence on the front end. And plus, what nobody really wants to talk about, I'm not blaming the police for everything, but one of the gentlemen was saying that, why are the police dropping the ball? The police are definitely dropping the ball under Superintendent McCarthy. All of Superintendent McCarthy's strategies have failed in Chicago. We need a young superintendent of police in Chicago that knows the back alleys of Chicago. And on behalf of the work that my staff do, because it's not as newsworthy. You know, I've been over there on 80th and Damon where Tyshawn Lee was killed. See, my staff stops some of these killings on the front end whenever we get whimmed of something that's going on in the community. And we know how to go and talk to the individuals before they kill one another. So far this year, I don't believe in big numbers, but we've mediated about 45 conflicts this year where someone could have lost their life, and we mediated the conflicts on the front end, okay? And that's more important to me. But in regards to Ms. Pryor being killed, they say the young lady put her hands up in the air. The guy shot her anyway. And we have an issue of self-hatred in our community, and you cannot police self-hatred. See, that's another reason why the police can't solve it, because it's hard to police self-hatred, okay?
Well, I'm glad you said that, Megan. And this is David out here. I'm the one who made that comment earlier. Talk to us about what we need to do in our community. We understand that there are systemic issues of racism and financial disenfranchisement, no jobs, and those things. We don't necessarily have control over those things, but talk about what we need to do in our community to start policing ourselves and to get this problem under control.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. Right now, the main strategy would be we need to organize around maybe a good, I would say about 1,000 families, okay, men, women, to hit the streets in Chicago every weekend and talk to the shooters. You can't just go out there and talk to just, you know, just the average kids. And we want to protect the average kids as well, don't get me wrong. But the message has to go directly to the shooters out there. We're asking you as a community to stop the killing. And you have to do it on a regular basis every weekend. We need resources also. We can bring these young guys into different events every weekend. I'm talking about if we were to take 500 young men off the streets on the east side, 500 off the west side, 500 off the south side, and 500 young men off the north side, because they do have a little killing on the north side as well, and we have activities for them, like I call it the ultimate sacrifice for peace, where we keep these young guys with us from, let's say, 8 p.m. until 8 p.m. the next day. I'm talking about just on Saturday itself. Saturday night at 8 p.m. until Sunday at 8 o'clock, then we let them go home. They'll be tired and everything, and keep them busy overnight because, you know, we have to get these guys off the streets, educate them. And I've done this type of work before. That's why I'm putting it out there. Okay, So that's one of the strategies that really needs to take place right now. You got to get people going to the guys, the shooters. They call them the shooters. Say, look, man, as a black man, as your brother, I'm asking you, and then you have some women with you, we're asking you guys to think before you take a life, and would you put the guns down, you know, so we can kind of like have some type of peace in our community. And I guarantee you it would work to a degree. We can probably get the violence down by at least 60% as far as the homicide rate. Now, another thing that happened in Boston, there was an African-American pastor, Eugene Rivers, back in 1994. They actually went a whole year without one homicide of a 17-year-old or younger person for a whole year because they took to the streets the same way I'm talking about it right now, okay? So that's one of the strategies I think we really need to put in play, because what happens, this is not about, see, the thing when I said self-hatred, see, you cannot police self-hatred because what happens, you don't know how it looks. Young guys get into an argument, a petty argument, and they want to kill each other just like that. That's a manifestation of self-hatred. Somebody's bringing guns in this community as well. We have so many stories of illegal guns being dropped off in the community. Young guys are breaking in freight trains, and they get the guns, semi-automatic weapons and everything. And then we got the people pumping the dope in the community. But this is the problem. A lot of the killings are not really about the dope, believe it or not. It's not really all about gangbanging. Most of these killings are all about interpersonal conflict. That's what the killings are about. You look at the different motives. So we have a lot of work to do, but that's when you ask me that question, that would be one of the first strategies that I would implement to, you know, bring an immediate reduction in some of these homicides.
Excellent answer, and I appreciate that. That is so enlightening because you probably in that 2 minutes just destroyed about three preconceived notions that I've had. I certainly thought that most of the killings were about the drug wars in this country and in this city. So to hear that these are about interpersonal relationships and that basically a lot of these killings could be reduced by teaching people conflict resolution skills, I think that information alone is a game changer, because obviously then that completely changes how you address them. And I think when you look at it that way, it helps us look at the children more as people and right. in a more humanistic way as to how this needs to be treated. Because once we write them off as criminals, I think that plays a role in how we go ahead and try to treat them, if we try to treat them at all, as opposed to just writing them off. So right. With that said, viewing them as people and not as criminals and people that can be redeemed, is it a matter of them just not having too much idle time? Is that a big part of the problem? You say you keep them, you know, 8 to 8. Just giving them, it sounds like just giving them something to do helps to stem that problem.
Well, yeah, back around two years ago, I organized an Ultimate Sacrifice for Peace event at the Salvation Army Croc Center and over in the, I think it was the Roseland community, way far south. And I had the guys come and meet with me from 8 o'clock at night to 8 the next morning. We had activities all through the night. We had hip-hop detox brothers, you know, working with, you know, educating people about the hip-hop business. We had workout sessions. They can lift weights. I had an Olympic gold medalist there, you know, Brother Bennett. I forget his first name right now, but Brother Bennett was there with me, and he was teaching them some techniques. And then we had sessions for the young guys, the history of gangs, the purpose of drugs in our community. But let me say this to you also. See, you got to understand this, and people really need to get this point. If it was not for the African-American youth killing one another, selling dope and creating chaos in the community, a lot of systems would not be functional as far as, you know, the penitentiary system, you know, the county jail system, the state's attorney system. See, everybody's making money of black folks' tragedy, and our tragedies right now are taking place with our youth. Another thing that's going on, if it was not for the young man selling the dope and all that, you know, you got to have probation officers, you got to have a juvenile justice center, and, you know, and the story goes on and on and on, but the point I'm making, our people have to wake up and educate the young people. Hopefully they will listen, because everybody's benefiting off black folks' failures but us. And let me go a little deeper with you. You got all the stores in our community, at least around 70% of them are owned by other people. I'm not knocking other people, but what happened to black-owned businesses right in the community where young guys can go, instead of selling dope, they can work in a neighborhood business and make enough money till they become a college graduate, and then they move on and help some other people. See, we as black leaders have failed our people. See, it's not incumbent upon the police to solve the problems in the black community. That's something we have to do, and every time somebody gets shot and killed, everybody's on the news talking about what they're going to do after the fact. It happens time and time again. And you got these academic people with these experimental programs in the black community. Well, first of all, let me say this to you. You got George Kellins out of New York. This is what McCarthy believes in, the broken window theory. Lock people up for petty level crimes. That way you can deter them from committing higher level crimes. That theory is not holding up in Chicago. The other theory McCarthy implemented was the David Kennedy approach. That approach, David Kennedy is a Caucasian professor out of John Jay College, and people that are listening can look this information up. His approach, round up the toughest brothers, put pressure on them, put pressure on their families and the guys that they hang out with, and that'll reduce the homicides. That theory is not holding up. Okay, so this is what you get. Everybody's experimenting in the black community, and a lot of people are benefiting off the fact that we are not unified. If black folks would unify, and not to take over the system, just in our community, you would have an 80% reduction in killings probably overnight. If black folks would start seeing each other as one people and stop playing this hate game with one another, because the disunity and the self-hatred plays out in religion, politics, and on the streets. Our young brothers fail because a people without a vision would perish. Our ancestors stood in the gap for us, and now we got to stand in the gap for these young guys because they don't know what they're doing.
Brother Teo, absolutely. Thank you so much for what you shared. You brought up a couple of things. I really appreciate how you have put a laser-like focus on the systemic injustice that plays a role in what's happening in our community. And there are a couple of systems that touch the lives of our children every day. One being the education system that you talked about briefly. The other is systems of economic development, black-owned businesses and such. So if you could tell us in 3 or 4 points, what does the system of education in Chicago and what does the system of economic development in Chicago need to be doing in order to curtail this issue we're having with our kids being murdered?
Well, the educational system, you know, I don't have a whole lot of commentary about education because, you know, believe it or not, I believe in pulling yourself up from your bootstraps. I'm not a Republican. I want to make that clear. But the thing is, I grew up in the heart of the ghetto like a lot of us did. And I can remember being so broke, I didn't even want no money. I don't know if people can identify with that, but I can remember being uptight in a major way. I'm just being straight up with you guys, okay? And my thing is, I had to go to work. I was 16 years old. I started working day labor, trying to make some things happen. Then I used to do promotions on the side and went back to school, dropped out of high school, went back to get my GED. Then I graduated with my master's degree a few years later. But the point I'm making is I see a lack of drive in some of my young brothers and sisters nowadays because everybody's waiting on somebody to do something for them. And so back to your question about the educational system, I think that the young men that are in these some of these schools, it's all about the family. See, the family has to be strong in order to push the kids forward. That's an important key in the success of anybody. But we definitely need to make some changes within the school systems. But I'm not really so caught up in the schools. I'm more so caught up in black leadership myself because we as black men have to organize in mass numbers to reach our youth, and that's something we're not doing. And we keep on waiting on the system to do something for us, and it's a bad outlook. Now, as far as economics, how did we become a people that became more of a consumer than a producer? Here it is, and I don't have nothing against the Arabs. I don't have nothing against the Indians. The Indians own the gas stations. The Arabs own the liquor stores and the grocery stores, and the Koreans own the nail shops and the cleaners. We have to find a way to take over all the businesses in our community and then take the message to these young brothers on the streets. Look here, I want you to work for me. You're not going to make no big money in here. They're not making big money in the drug game now anyway. That's a myth. I want to make that clear to everybody, and I know this as a fact. Now, the thing is, you work, then you own some businesses, and you turn them over to your kids' kids. And that's what the Arabs are doing. That's what the Koreans are doing. People are taking big, big duffel bags full of money out the black community every night while we're struggling to just to pay a bill or make ends meet, okay? So economically, black leadership, male and female, professionals and everyday laymen's people, we have to, it's our job to rebuild the black community so these young guys have a sense of pride in the black community, okay? Now, this is too deep for some listeners. I want to make this clear to everybody. This may be too deep. You have
That's
to understand,
all right. Go ahead, brother.
There are some powers that be out there that are smuggling illegal guns into our community, and the people don't look nothing like us, okay? Another thing that's happening when it comes to the dope game, the dope pipeline comes out of Mexico, and you got the people. See, you got to understand, the black community is the only community struggling with this. You don't see the Mexican community marching like this, even though they have a few killings over there, but the thing is, the dope pipeline comes all the way through Mexico. So you got some diabolical people doing their best to destroy the black race, you know, to a degree. And I'm not saying this for everybody, but you even have a lot of guys. I'm hearing this from the streets now. I want to make that clear. The police will lock a guy up, for example, that just shot at two people. They lock him up, and if he tells on somebody else, he gets out of jail because he didn't gave up two or three other shooters, or he told the police where a gun was at. Now, I understand the fundamentals of police work, but you letting another shooter out on the streets that you know shot somebody because he gave somebody else up. And then what the police do, they have undercover investigations that last for a year or two. And during the investigation period, many people are killed. A lot of dope is being sold in the community, you know, like in that area when they investigate people. So you got the police are going to have to man up and be honest about some of this misdealings themselves. See, people don't want to talk about that. And I'm not saying all police, but you got a certain percentage of the police that are not taking care of the business the proper way out there. So just the moral of the story, a lot of our young brothers are being set up in the community as well.
I know my good friend, and thank you for all that excellent information. We, again, appreciate you so much. I know my good friend David here wants to piggyback on some of the things that you just said about pulling yourself up by your bootstrap. I know he's had some thoughts on that as well.
Well, no, I just really appreciate how you're framing the argument, and you're basically saying, in other words, that this is a choice. I mean, we can talk about all the systemic issues. We can talk about the lack of access to jobs and business owners, you know, owning your own business and going to school. But this 9-year-old boy who was killed, someone made a choice to kill him. This young lady who was killed, someone chose to shoot her. And I don't.
Right.
And I think it's really important that while we talk about these other systemic issues, that we really need to. And again, and I believe in all of those systemic issues. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, I understand.
Dave and I had these conversations at length, but we cannot remove the responsibility of the individual who's pulling the trigger. We cannot.
No doubt about it.
Once we do that, we lose the argument.
You know, I would just add to that, David, that you know. And Brother Teal kind of touched on this a little bit, is the condition of the black family, which is also a system when you think about it,
right?
That we're talking about the choices that these kids are making, but they're making them based on the system they came out of and the quality of that system. If the quality of the system they emerge from is already broken and suffering, then what it's going to produce is a person who is broken and suffering. And so while I concur with you that the systemic issues have been and continue to be just that, systemic issues. But the fundamental issue that I think we need to start addressing, the one that any one of us as a member of a black family can do something about today, right? We don't have to wait for a politician.
Right.
We don't have to wait for a system. We don't have to wait for any of those things to change to start sowing positive seeds and planning and being intentional about the family that we're raising children in. So I just want to underscore, there is no, we can't do anything about it. If each one of us would take responsibility for the children who are part of our family, transformation will come almost immediately.
Yes. And I concur with you, young lady, because that's what I'm pushing. We have to have family responsibility, because I just have to speak for myself right now. You know, I have some nephews. You know, they some gopher tough guys, but I have all those guys working jobs right now because I went over there and kind of like put my foot down on them. And just give you an example of what I'm talking about, I have a nephew, they call him Trigger, you know, and you know what they call him Trigger for. When I found out they were calling him Trigger and he got these tattoos in his face, I went over there and snapped out on him and took him down to the basement. We had a little session and everything. And now he's working a job. We got the tattoo removed out of his face. See, we have to find a way to make sure we take care of our own family first, and then we start helping a lot of young men out there that need the help. But that's very important, family responsibility, because if the families were to tell some of these shooters, now let me make this clear, there was no excuse to shoot 9-year-old Tyshawn Lee. I don't want to make no excuses because of the system and all that. The guys that shot him were just some straight-up evil, diabolical individuals, and they need to be dealt with without a doubt. Okay, but at the same time, if the families would tell their young cousins, look, if I find out you over here shooting in the neighborhood, we're going to bar you from our family. You will not be welcome at the family reunion, and you got to stand on that stuff. I'll never forget this experience I had over on the west side a few years ago. There was a family called the Braylock Brothers. It was about maybe 20 of these guys, and they were some of the roughest guys over here on the 1000 block of North Leamington on the west side, and they had an uncle that was a postman. I don't know what the uncle had over them, but these guys were shooting up the whole block. Whenever strangers come on the block, if they didn't know who you were, they'd shoot, ask questions later. When their uncle came on the block, all those guys got in line. They respected their uncle, and whenever I talked to him, and then the guys started respecting me as an end result of that too because of the uncle, but he was able to put those guys in check. And now a lot of those guys are working. A few of them got locked up, but the majority of those brothers over there, cousins, whoever they were, some of those guys are working jobs now, okay? So the family is key. The family is key all the way.
It sounds like from what you're saying as well, what seems to be the recurring theme from what I'm hearing is the word job. And I've heard it mentioned several times today, and you just said it about three times in one sentence. And does it really just come down to we need to get some employment in our community?
No, it's not all about jobs. Let me make that clear because I have the numbers all the time as far as homicides. Back in the late 70s, you almost had 1,000 homicides within one of those years in the decade of the 70s. Now, there were all kinds of jobs back in the 70s, okay? But the gang landscape was different back then. You had the birth of the gang nations back then. Guys were killing a lot then because you had guys trying to carve off territory, you know, like the south side, west side, east side, and everything. Now, in the 80s, you had almost 1,000 killings in one of those years as well because you had the introduction of crack cocaine, and everybody started making a lot of money in the gangs. And in the 90s, you had a year where you had like 900 homicides in one of those years. So fast track to year 2013, 2014, we had like a little bit over like 430, 440 homicides, and in 2013, I think homicides were a little bit over 500. Now, the thing is, the homicides have come down a lot if you compare it to the last, previous decades, but jobs were available. It's not always about jobs. It's about the way people think because you have a homicide. Now, Chicago is rough, but you compare Chicago to Rio de Janeiro over in Brazil, you compare Chicago to Kingston, Jamaica, or some cities in Mexico, we those cities outshine Chicago every day because they have, in Kingston one year, you had 2,800 murders. In Kingston in one of those years, okay? So the thing is, it's not always about jobs because people can go to work and still have loathing in their heart to want to hurt somebody. We have a lack of brotherhood right now, a lack of unity. That's what's killing us. And you have a lot of people out there with mental health issues. That's another long story because, and then hurt people hurt other people. And let me say this to you also about Tyshawn Lee. I mean, you know, word has it his father was involved in some stuff that hurt some people some time ago, and the people wanted to get him back by doing something to his son. And now I'm hearing stories about his son being on Facebook. I haven't confirmed it, but I just got a call before the show holding up, you know, gang signs. You know, even though he's 9 years old, and I forgive that young man for anything he could have ever thought about doing, but they say he was holding up gang signs and his father was taking him with him, you know, trying to show him the ways of the street life, okay? So we have people that are teaching these young guys how to become gangbangers or whatever you might say, and that's not right. So it's passed down behavior, and unfortunately, Tyshawn should not have lost his life for nothing. But it's unfortunate that some of the parents are passing down the wrong values to their kids.
It sounds like there are enough systemic and epidemic issues to go around, and so
Yeah.
As we have identified the family as the base, as it well should be, and the power behind that base, I think we have a point of leverage. But what I would also add is that that doesn't detract from any of the other issues that we have named, be it education, economic development, you know, the creation of jobs, the giving youth something to preoccupy their time, develop interest. And I think all of those things absolutely play a role as well in who we're shaping as we think about the Black community.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Let me ask you this as well, because earlier in the conversation you had mentioned Black leadership and you'd mentioned failed Black leadership or misguided Black leadership. Let me ask you this. In your mind, what does effective Black leadership look like?
Effective Black leadership is from the ground up, okay? And let me give you an example. And I don't promote the mobsters or the mafiosa, but Lucky Luciano, you can look this up. This is in the history books. What he did is he brought all the Italian and Jewish and Irish gangsters together because they was killing each other in record numbers even back in the 1920s, whatever the case may be. And when he brought them together, it led to the birth of organized crime. So they stopped killing each other because they began to realize as a white people, Caucasian people, that, you know, it wasn't right to kill their brothers the way that they were killing them. So not to say that Lucky Luciano's motto was the right motto, but it led to peace amongst the white gangs, okay, back in the yesteryear. So when I talk about effective Black leadership, Black leaders that see this happening in their community, we should be outraged to a point where we get real busy and begin to work on a plan to stop the killing. We have brilliant minds out here. See, what happens is that everybody, it becomes sensational, the killings. You know, I don't knock Spike Lee. I'm glad he filmed a movie that's going to highlight what's going on in Chicago, and I just hope that some resources will come from that, too, to help stop some of the killings. And like I say, not always about the money, just coming out, talking to the young brothers, trying to get them to level, you know, become more level-minded. So Black, when I say failed Black leadership, we get caught up as a people in what's popular. The kind of work I'm talking about is not for the faint at heart. Do not try this at home. There was an incident where a young guy had grabbed this other guy. The guy's name was Lil Donnie, and the guy that grabbed him's name was Sean. And his mother called me, and I rushed over on the scene, and Sean was about to kill this kid, okay? And when I rushed over there, Sean told me he'll put me to sleep if I keep meddling in his business, all right? And I looked at him. He told me twice. He said, "You heard what I said. I'll put you to sleep if you keep meddling in my business." I say, "My man, I'm not here meddling your business, but you're trying to kill this young guy for some misinformation. He did not do what you thought he did." And I had the facts. I'm not going to tell you the whole story, but to make a long story short, I put myself in the face of death to save a young guy. And now little Donnie works at Walmart. He doesn't have a big-time job, but he's off the streets and he's working because I saved his life personally, okay? So, and the reason I tell you this story is because we need Black men that can go out there and get right into the middle of all this mess and stop this killing on the front end, all right? On the front end, that's what I'm talking about. And failed leadership is when you don't bring enough resources to your people. We have a city of Chicago that everybody depends on the Black vote to become the mayor. And we don't have, I'm not saying an African-American mayor would make the biggest difference, but if everybody's depending on us, we need to make sure that the leadership bring the necessary resources to the community to help these young brothers. Everybody wants to go around the killers. You're not going to stop a killing unless you know the killer, you got a relationship with the killer where that person will listen to you at that moment in time in their life, okay? You're not going to stop a killing otherwise. Right now, the main message is to go to the killers in Chicago as Black leaders and bring the killing down. That's what I mean by failed leadership. Everything else, we don't really need to talk about nothing else other than going to the killers and asking them to stop killing their own people, okay? And the leaders would rather go on the news and give a press conference and pray, which I've done that too. I pray for the people. But we got to go deeper than prayer now and go right into the belly of the beast. And that's what the leaders are not doing. They're waiting on the police to do that.
That's the realest thing you said, man. It's time out for this praying and protesting and marching. And that's it.
Yeah, I mean, faith without works is dead is basically what you're saying. And we definitely have some work to put into it. Mr. Hardiman, I can't thank you enough for being on today. If you could just tell our listeners how they can support you, find you.
Yeah. You can visit my website, tohardiman.com. That's T-I-O, HARDIMAN, or you can send me an email at TIO_H@yahoo.com, and then I'll put my number out there. You can contact me directly at 773-391-9072, and I'm one of the most direct people you'll ever talk to. I just want to make that clear.
Oh, no, you made that clear already.
Definitely. Definitely.
And we thank you not only for what you've done for our show today, but we thank you for your work.
All
right. And what you've done for our community.
Thank you.
Because not everybody can say. There's a lot of people that you know, can, like you say, they're academics, and they got a lot of very smart things to say, but they're not on the front line.
That's what I'm talking about.
And we definitely will not overlook that here today on We Hear You. It's up to you. We're going to go ahead and get into Officer Glenowitz right now, but if you'd like to stay with us, you can. If you've got to go, we understand. It's completely up to you, Mr. Hardeman.
No, just keep me in your prayers, brothers and sisters, but I have to go now, and then thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brother Hardeman.
We definitely want you to be a friend of the show.
No problem at all.
All right.
All right, man.
All right, we hear you. All right.
Good guess. That was a good conversation.
Any closing thoughts on that, Ms. Washington? Oh, no, Ms. Washington.
Oh.
One thing that resonates with me for certain is Brother Hardeman talked about in terms of academics studying something and taking their studies and theories. And before we can get to the place where we understand and or have a relationship with the people and superimposing programs in our communities, when they haven't talked to the community or developed any planning based out of the voices of the people who live there. And then they wonder why they keep coming up empty-handed. This is happening not just in Chicago, but all over the country. And unless we start to engage people beyond the scholarly perspective, you know, and recognize the value in the experience that people have just living in a community or neighborhood, I don't know that we're going to come up with solutions that are ever really beneficial to the people who live in that particular community.
All right. Well, thank you all, and I appreciate being on the show.
All right, thank you, sir. Take care. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Take care.
T.O. Hardeman, everybody.
Man. Good wisdom.
So now we're going to, kind of on a related topic, talk about still Officer Glenowitz and the unfortunate situation that happened with him and his apparently now a suicide. I mean, everybody's kind of familiar with the story, but in case you're not, well, as a matter of fact, we got somebody on that's very qualified to talk to us about this, and that is Ms. Ruth Fuller. She is a freelance journalist currently working for the Chicago Sun-Times. She has been a freelance journalist for some time, but she's done more than that. She is also a communications consultant for Cure Epilepsy. She has also been a freelance reporter for the Chicago Tribune Media Group, and she's also been director of communications for University of Illinois at Chicago. And again, we could go on and on about her qualifications, but again, we have a very qualified person here today to talk to us about this situation. She's actually written about it as well. Ms. Fuller, how are you today?
I'm great, but I don't know how you expect me to follow T.O. That was pretty excellent conversation there. And I worked at University of Illinois Chicago, I worked with T.O., so he's a wonderful guest to have on.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I have every confidence that you will fill those shoes today in the next 20 minutes
Thank
that
you.
We have left. So if you could just kind
Thank
of,
you.
For the uninitiated that is listening to the show but may not be aware, if you could just kind of give us a brief synopsis of what happened with Mr. Glenowitz.
I don't know if there's such a thing as a brief synopsis of what happened. This has been quite an interesting and, crazy case. I don't know that I've ever covered anything quite so confusing. It started a little over 2 months ago on September 1st. We got a call that there was an officer shot and killed in Fox Lake, and there was a really fast police presence and presence from everywhere, all the surrounding communities and Homeland Security and all types of other authorities coming out to try to find the suspects in this case. Officer Glinowitz had radioed in that he was pursuing three suspects, one black and two white suspects on foot. And this was about just before 8 in the morning. Very soon after that, he was found this was in a marshy area in Fox Lake, and he was found and he had been shot. And police were telling us at the time that there were signs of a struggle. And initially they were telling us that the gun was missing. A couple hours later, they said they found the gun. So it took them a while, actually weeks, to even tell us anything. And when I say us, I'm talking about the media, anything about the ballistics findings, anything about gunshot residue findings. And this was really, this is not something that's commonplace in any kind of murder case. Out in Lake County specifically, we get results very fast. And you would especially assume that in a case this big, with this kind of intense national attention that it garnered, and in a case where it's the death of a police officer, they would have gotten the results really quickly. But it took them at least 2 weeks before they had any lab results back. And they police continued to say that they were looking for these suspects. At one point, the investigators on this case, who are the Lake County Major Crimes Task Force, said that they did have suspects that they found from some video tape analysis that they got. Now, fortunately for these three guys, these three guys that they took in and interrogated happened to have rock-solid alibis. Because Lake County, I don't know if you know, has a history of wrongful convictions. We've had 6 wrongful convictions overturned just since 2010. So,
wow.
Yeah, and that's just the ones that we know of right now. And, you know, there's others that are waiting. So, so these guys really could have very likely been 3 more had they not had rock-solid alibis. But they did. They had receipts. They were in restaurants at the time. They were very, very lucky. And they just happened to fit the 2 white guys and a black guy. There was absolutely no other physical description given by Lieutenant Glinowitz. So I found this very interesting. It also took police a week, investigators a week, to even talk to the family of Lieutenant Glinowitz. Now, if that was any other person who was shot dead, do you think it would take a week to talk to their family? I mean, you know, we were all really surprised by that, and we questioned that quite a bit in the media, why it took them a week. Because usually, you know, that's the first thing that happens. You go and you talk to family members. So that was something that we questioned right away as well in the media. So for weeks and weeks and weeks, they continued to say, well, this is being investigated as a homicide. Several weeks into it, the Lake County coroner, who is Thomas Rudd, came out and said, well, I can't rule out suicide. And he was absolutely raked over the coals by the Lake County Major Crimes Task Force and said that he was unprofessional. They said that he was jeopardizing the investigation for even suggesting that it could be a suicide. And all he was doing was merely doing his job, because, you know, he's the one who at that point has to give a ruling on the cause of death. So he was actually the only one who was being honest at that point, because, you know, now we know that they had signs very early on that this was a suicide, but back then they wouldn't give any hint of it. So stop me at any point if I'm giving you too much information, but I told you this is a complicated story. So
yeah, absolutely.
So then,
no, I definitely wanted to go through it, because you've actually revealed some things that I never knew. I wasn't aware
really?
Of how long it had taken them to talk to the family. And again, even if we do know those details, as a regular person, we don't know the context of what those things mean. So we don't know that it's unusual for them to take that long to maybe talk to a family member.
Right.
What have you. So those, you know, again, to shed that kind of light is certainly enlightening. Let's go ahead. Let me ask you this. We've looked at let's look at some of the fallout from what has happened. So now we can fast forward to where we know it's a suicide.
We find out it's a suicide.
And what is the benefit of him committing suicide, by the way? What is his end game with that? A potential end game?
Well, we find out it's a suicide, and we find out that he had been stealing money for 7 years from a fund that was set up for the Explorer Group, which is through the Boy Scouts of America, and it's to train children to have more interest in law enforcement. And he ran that for Fox Lake. And he'd been stealing money from that for 7 years, using it for things like paying his mortgage, taking trips, porn sites, and just general cash to use for whatever else he wanted to use it for, I guess. And we also uncovered at the Sun-Times that his wife and son are being investigated, because his wife appears that his wife was sort of acting as some sort of treasurer or something. She was helping him with the funds to sort of move the funds around or figure out when the funds needed to be in which count, so things wouldn't be figured out. And the son, I don't know if you've seen that the latest on the son having set up a sham marriage. Do you know this part of the story?
I had heard about that.
Right.
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
You can go ahead and
lie. So, okay. So there was a, Officer Glennowitz was having an affair with a woman, and this woman got a divorce, and this is kind of too much. It's like a made for TV movie, I know, but this
right?
is all this is all reality. So he was the woman was getting a divorce, and she needed to have benefits. So he arranged for his son to marry this woman. His son is in the army, and so his son would give her benefits from the army, the health care and dental care and that type of thing, and then his son would also get paid more for having a wife and kids. And
so everybody wins.
Everybody wins, right? And then, you know, Lieutenant Glennowitz still has his mistress on the side, and his son gets to give her the money and the benefits. So, yeah, so he's being investigated for that.
Because she's married to his son.
Right. Exactly. It was about a year-long marriage, so I don't know how long, you know. I don't know. Actually, they never lived together either, so I don't know that anyone even knew they were married other than the army. So anyway, there was a new village administrator in Fox Lake who was finally catching on. I guess for 7 years, I was told. I asked the question why no one caught on for 7 years, but for some reason no one noticed for 7 years that he was stealing this money. And finally, this new village administrator noticed, started looking at the books and noticed, and he didn't like that very much. And he was looking at ways to get rid of her. He talked about hiring a hitman, actually made some phone calls about hiring a hitman and texts. And we have texts that show that he was thinking of hiring a hitman. He was looking at planting cocaine on her so she would get busted with the cocaine. He had a lot of different thoughts for her. But in the end, I guess it all became too much for him, and he decided to take his own life.
But by doing that, there's still a financial benefit, right? Because then his family would get his pension if it looked as if
right.
he died in the line of duty.
Oh, his pension is just the, you know, that was just a small part of it. You know, his pension, she still gets his pension, no matter whether he committed suicide or not, because you can only not get the pension if you're convicted of something, and you can't convict a dead man. So she'll still get his
wow.
pension. Yes.
Wow.
She'll still get his pension. But she would have gotten, if he, see, this is why he wanted to make it look like he was killed in the line of duty. She would have gotten death benefits for being killed in the line of duty, which are, you know what, I don't even know exactly the figures, but quite a bit of money. And then also his life insurance, which we haven't
right.
uncovered how much, but I think she would have stood to gain millions, let's just say. And there were also so many fundraisers held for the family, and hundreds of thousands of dollars were raised for the family. They were in very, very good financial shape because he was killed in the line of duty, and that's how he wanted to set it up
well,
so his
well,
family
okay,
was.
Sorry. No, just listening to how intimately or how the intimate knowledge you have of the process and timelines
mm-hmm.
and how quickly things should or should not happen. The thought that occurs to me is that whenever we hear a story about a bad cop, you know, the first thing that we hear
mm-hmm.
is, well, you know, not all cops are bad. But when you see a story like this where you've got all these interweaving narratives and the ways he's trying to defraud this group and that group. And I mean, and that he got away with it for 7 years. I mean, it's kind
mm-hmm.
of hard to accept the word of law enforcement at face value if somebody could get away with all of this for that length of time.
Yeah, and it goes well past that, because we looked into his personnel file, and he had complaints against him for many, many years. People from the police station, other officers wrote anonymous letters to the mayor because the chief was one of his best friends and refused to do anything about it. He had a sexual harassment lawsuit filed against him in 2000, I believe it was, or 2001, in which another female police officer accused him of forcing her to perform sexual acts on him, a subordinate, which he you know, forced her to perform these acts. He was accused of grabbing women's breasts. He was accused of getting drunk and passing out while he was working. He was accused of, I mean, so the list goes on and on and on. And the fact that nothing was ever done, and this was going on all while he was continuing to rise up the ranks in the police department. And he was apparently even being looked at for a chief's position at another police department. So, absolutely, David, you're completely right. I mean, you do question it. And, you know, you have to say, what? And you know what? I have to go beyond that. because where and why did all this hero worship come, you know,
right.
when he died?
We do not understand the hero worship.
And we do not understand
also what we don't understand is why, because all the information you're saying now is readily available, but it's only readily
right.
available now because they're ready to throw him under the bus.
Right.
Why didn't we
they
know this 5 years ago? Why didn't we know this 10 years ago?
Well, absolutely. And the thing is that they wouldn't let any of this out until they decided to determine it as suicide. But they knew on day one it was a suicide. I mean,
there's no
question, because there was so much evidence that, you know, there was so much evidence right from the beginning that it was a suicide. They just didn't want to, you know, let the information out until they could prove in no uncertain terms that it was a suicide. However, let me tell you, there was no reason they had to continue to say for 2 months that it was a homicide. They could have, from the very beginning, say, we're investigating this, but this could be a suicide. You know, they didn't have to let this be the hero worship that it was, and where people came from across the nation to this man's funeral. I've never seen anything like this, this funeral. I've never seen anything like it.
Right.
I guess I would look at it from the flip side, where I would ask myself, mm-hmm. like, we're looking at it from the bottom to the top, sort of all of the things that this officer did and the end
mm-hmm.
result being hero worship. I think in some
mm-hmm.
regard there must have been some of that going on all along for him to have the record that he had, the folder, the employee folder that he had, and still be able to move up the ranks. And I wonder how our own desire to create opportunities for hero worship develops
right.
in mental illness and other people, and potentially creates a scenario where a person commits suicide because they can't get from underneath the hero worship. So that's another, you know, instead of looking at it from the base up, there's this possibility to kind of look at it from the top down. Like, what pressure does hero worship create on our potential leaders of our communities and
mm-hmm.
this ended in suicide? And then the other thing I would tag with that, hero worship is not a healthy thing, and neither is suicide. So what are the evaluations for mental capacity and effectiveness, and how are we measuring that capacity and effectiveness in our police before we send them out into the street?
You know what, that is such a great point, because when I when all this came about, I said something on my own Facebook page about how I thought that the whole funeral and all the hero worship had been so unhealthy, because what I thought is that there was no reason we needed to, in the first place, to put him above any one of just what you were talking about earlier, the Tyshawn Lee and the Kalen Pryor and, you know, all the other children who've been losing their lives lately. And, you know, why is one person's death any more important than anyone else's? So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
why do we make any one person that much more significant than another simply because of the job they do? And
mm-hmm.
so I think that if we put that kind of, and I think you're right. I mean, I think maybe he became a hero in people's eyes because he was working with children, and certainly these children looked up to him, and I think he probably did feel intense pressure when he knew everything was going to be exposed and everyone would know him. I think he probably had a tremendous ego, and I think everyone would know him for the truth, you know, that he was not that hero that people were making him out to be.
Well, we're going to have to, I don't mean to cut you off, but we got about 40
yep.
seconds left to close
yep.
the show. However, that doesn't mean you have to go, because we can actually continue to talk about this and have our listeners, if they'd like to hear the archive segment, we can go another few minutes, because there's actually a couple of questions that I know David has and that I'd like to get into that we haven't even scratched the surface on yet. In the last few seconds, we do want to thank our listeners for being with us today. I want to thank Breon Jones for producing such an excellent show. And we look forward to next week on We Hear You.
You still there, Ruth?
I'm here.
Okay. I was listening to what you were saying earlier, and it just struck me. When you said that you were pretty sure that these police officers knew from the very beginning that this was a suicide, and then that just shows how insidious it is because they allowed the narrative of the Black Lives Matter movement being one of the potential culprits for this police officer's murder. And if what you're saying is true, that they knew from the very beginning that it was a suicide, that just shows that, I mean, now the story is bigger than Officer Glenowitz. Now we're talking about the entire Fox Valley Police Department.
Fox Lake, but yeah, you're...
Fox Lake, I'm sorry.
No, it's not even the Fox Lake Police Department. It's Lake County. It's Lake County on a whole. It's the Lake County Major Crime Task Force, and what that's comprised of is every police department that's at least big enough in Lake County contributes one police officer to the Lake County Major Crimes Task Force. And then the task force comes in whenever there's a major crime or a police-involved shooting, and they investigate that crime. So the task force has been involved in probably all of those six wrongful convictions that I was telling you about. So yes, it is. It is bigger, and I do think it's an issue. There were so many signs right in the very beginning that it was a suicide, and there were so many members of the media knew it was a suicide right in the beginning. And if we could figure it out, there's no reason the police officers couldn't figure it out.
Here's the other thing we want to consider as well, as far as fallout. We're looking at a $300,000 price tag for this investigation.
For
people that...
That was just the first
day. So we're looking at $300,000. So we're probably looking at easily over $500,000. It's probably, if not upwards of $1 million. We're looking at money that he had.
No, it's over $1 million. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. So we're looking at money that he had stolen, money that he wanted to continue to steal through his pension. So that's the hardline fallout. But let's talk about some of the things that you can't count with money. When we look at the devastation that these children are dealing with, in looking at their fallen hero. Someone that they thought was their hero and turned out to be, not only was he not a hero, but he was a crook. And he was a crook literally on their backs, on a program that was supposed to benefit them so he could get porn sites and go on vacation, probably things that some of their parents probably couldn't even afford to do. We have the fallout from the Black Lives Matter movement being blamed for something that they obviously had nothing to do with, but not that we needed the investigation to know that that was the case anyway. But you cannot unring the bell, so to speak. So there are still people walking around with impressions of Black Lives Matter based on this situation and many others like it. I think those are the things that we kind of forget. Again, all the fallout that isn't attached to a dollar amount.
Other big loss that we can't ignore is that this human being who was clearly suffering some mental illness and definitely a very broken person took his life, you know. And if we're going to say that we shouldn't value some lives over other lives, then that means that we also, that the negation of that statement is also true, which means that we can't undervalue one life over another one either. And so I would say even in spite of these things that he did, you know, anybody can be reconciled to themselves if they're alive. But he's not even here anymore to answer any questions, to be transformed, you know, to have a different perspective. Life was lost, even if it was the case that he took his own. And so I wonder also what pressures were in place that would cause a person to act, as David said, so insidiously, and then have an entire department of people act in the same way. I think we have to question not just the person, definitely the person, but also what organism is being created in Fox Lake.
Yeah. Well,
and the police,
I mean,
cultures around the world. Because
sure.
I think that's common to police, for them to turn a blind eye, to blindly support Blue. Definitely there is a culture thing that would need to be discussed. I agree with you 100%, Rashida.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do too. It's this, you know, so-called thin blue line where they'll turn a blind eye. You know, there's stories in his personnel file where he got drunk, he passed out in his truck. So his fellow officers took him home and towed his truck, and then the next day he called the sheriff's department and reported his truck as being stolen. And there were no consequences. There were never any consequences for this man. So he continued. You know, there weren't consequences when he sexually harassed women. There weren't consequences for 7 years when he was stealing money from the funds. So, you know, he continued to do these things. And so, you know, this is his piggy bank, this Explorers Fund. And he acted as though, you know, good things are going to continue to happen to him. And then all of a sudden, when someone comes down on him, oh boy, you know, I'm not
to face the consequences.
Yeah, he can't handle it. So I think that it's time that police officers realize and start speaking up, because there are a lot of good police officers out there, and I think that it is time for them to start speaking up, just like, you know, your former conversation about gang members speaking up when they, you know, or people in the community speaking up when they see gang crime or what have you. I mean, police officers have to speak up when they are doing wrong, when they see others doing wrong. Forget this thin blue line thing. I mean, I think that's part of the problem.
Well, the irony in the whole thin blue line is that it's intended to protect the folks in blue, right? And then now we're watching mm-hmm. this man who was clearly suffering this entire time. For over a decade, this man has been suffering his own brokenness. And because of the irony of the thin blue line that's intended to protect him, he wasn't cared for. He wasn't protected from himself. And it ended in him taking mm-hmm. his own life.
Right. No, I agree.
And
I think
to remember in this entire situation, and I say it all the time, is that for every police officer out there, people always say, oh, well, all cops aren't bad. For every bad cop out there, there has to be another couple of cops that are looking the other way. And so when you start talking about the bad cops and the cops that are looking the other way, we're talking about an institution that's broken and needs to be deconstructed and reconstructed so that it can get back to its creed of serve and protect.
Yeah, institution that obviously doesn't have the ability to police itself.
Right. Right.
Is the heart, you know, one of the things that would have saved him was, again, because what happened? We had an outside auditor come in and he lost his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what needs to be done in these situations, is that there needs to be real, actual accountability. And you can, you know, again, I see the meme all the time. Well, we policed ourselves and we found nothing was nothing was done wrong.
Yes.
Right.
And that's what we have to get away from.
That's one of our biggest problems in Lake County. There has been these 6 wrongful convictions. There have been, you know, this kind of situation in Lake County, in Fox Lake. There's so many issues we have had in this county. I can't even begin to tell you what has gone on in this county. And we have had not a single outside representative come in. No, you know, no audits. We haven't had, you know, someone from the Illinois Attorney General's office come in. We haven't had anyone come in and say, hey, what is going on up there? You know, so why is it that this county continues to be able to self and regulate itself and get away with this kind of thing? I mean, that's the question. I don't.
Well,
we know that
Fox Lake is wrought with residents who inhabit an extended amount of power and wealth. And we often talk about the benefits of having privileges and entitlements. We hardly hear about the deficits of what comes with having that privilege and power unchecked. And this story mm-hmm. seems to be an example of what happens when people possess indiscriminate amounts of power and wealth and allow that system to monitor itself unchecked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great point. And, you know, we reported that Officer Glenowitz was making $96,000. I mean, he was making $96,000, and he had to steal from a children's fund. And he was stealing money. He was stealing money from a children's fund, making $96,000. I mean, you know, really. I mean, and I think back to I forgot now who made the point about the explorers and what do they, what happens to them now? I think that's one of the greatest points that I think hasn't been talked about enough yet. Mm-hmm. What about these kids? Because these kids really looked up to the man. I mean, when I was out there the first day or two after he died, there were some unbelievably broken hearts. These kids were lining the streets just holding up signs, you know, remembering him. And boy, you know, they really, really, this was their role model. And I don't know how they get past that, you know, now finding out that not only did they lose him, not only did they lose him in suicide, but that he was stealing from them. And he was trying to, you know, kill this woman who was investigating him, all these other things. I mean, they've learned so many horrible things about this man. I mean, you know, these are kids who want to go into law enforcement.
Well,
so,
and that's what's so powerful about it to me is that these are not just kids who kind of knew a man. These are kids, the Explorer kids are kids who want to go into law enforcement. And I think that, you know, in every affliction, there is some opportunity to learn and grow. And I wonder how this happened, this having happened, will affect the kind of law enforcers they become as the explorers who want to be future police officers.
We were told that two officers have taken up the group, and they're, you know, they're really paying a lot of attention and taking over the kids. But I hope these kids are going to be okay. I worry about them, and, you know, not to mention his, Officer Glenowitz's own other three boys who, you know, who knows if they were involved in any of this or had any knowledge. So, you know, there's a lot of tragedy, and there are a lot of victims in all of this. And it's a really sad story. So
we're going to have to leave it there. We do appreciate you so much today, Ms. Fuller. You have made this conversation so colorful, and really you have illuminated a lot of things that we did not, as thoroughly as this has been covered. Again, there was still a lot of information. I'm actually seeing Facebook posts from people that are saying, wow, I didn't know that, wow, I didn't know that, from some of our listeners. So we greatly appreciate you today.
Great.
We definitely, like Teal, we definitely want you to remain a friend of the show.
I sure will, and thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, thanks for coming on. And then, like I said, you brought up a lot of good information, and we'll definitely keep that information in mind. But hopefully this kind of story never happens again, but it probably will. So we'll be able to at least evaluate it a little bit more, a little differently the next time when and if something like this happens.
Absolutely. Well, you guys keep in touch. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Have
a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks. You too. Bye-bye.
There we go. Do it. I keep sort of in the call.